superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
If you're watching this, it means I'm dead.
A local screenwriter hits Hollywood success.
About a decade's worth of work and just dreams, and then all of a sudden you're in the Cayman Islands and shooting, and then the movie's done and it's at festivals. And yeah, it's just, it's hard to believe.
Daniel?
You think he's dead?
Not unless the dead breathe.
Right.
Get it done.
We'll preview Daniel's Gotta Die, written by Matt Dressel. But first, there are advantages to living near the border between two states, but filling out two tax returns isn't one of them.
And it's several thousand people in the Twin Ports. If you live in one state and you work in the other, you have to fill out two returns.
We'll look at efforts to bring tax reciprocity to Wisconsin and Minnesota.
Telling us that we're all standing on the border.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Along with the natural beauty and the never-ending snowstorms, it seems, a hallmark of our area is our relationships with our neighboring states. That means Wisconsin, if you're listening to us on the Minnesota side of the bay, and Minnesota or the UP, if you're in our part of Wisconsin. That has several advantages. One that I'm not supposed to advocate for is, did you know you could get 10 cents for an empty pop can at the Super One in Ironwood? And some disadvantages. Perhaps most importantly, your income tax filings in both states if you live in one and work across the border. If you do, you're not alone, and the issue was on the agenda for state lawmakers to consider at Superior Days in Madison in February. One of the point people for it is Mayor Jim Payne of Superior, and he joins me now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Mayor Payne.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
So what exactly is the problem? Would I have to pay twice as much income tax, or does each state only one half, or how does it work right now?
So nobody pays any more income tax than they owe. That's not the issue that we're solving. The problem is that if you live in one state and work in the other, you have to fill out a tax return for each state. And years ago, that wasn't the case. The states did that work for you, as they do with most of their other neighbors. So Wisconsin and Minnesota both have reciprocity agreements with their neighbors, except each other.
Oh, that's an interesting way of looking at geography. So what do you want Wisconsin to do? And can Wisconsin do it alone, or do they have to work, does this have to be a bilateral agreement?
Yep, both states have to agree. And years ago, over 10 years ago now, Minnesota ended the agreement because Wisconsin had a deficit in paying. So what happens is if you live in Wisconsin, you only owe Wisconsin income taxes, but your Minnesota employer would have been taking it out and sending it to the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and vice versa. That creates a deficit on the Wisconsin side. So Wisconsin was supposed to be paying it back. They weren't paying it back quick enough. And then Governor Tim Pawlenty in Minnesota ended the agreement. That ends up costing taxpayers a considerable amount of money each year, as most taxpayers have to pay to have their tax returns prepared for them, especially low-income taxpayers. So we're hoping that they just restore the agreement. It'll take cooperation from both departments of revenue and both legislatures, but we think we can get it done.
Mm-hmm. I joked about taking cans to Michigan. We can talk about that later. But did you say that both states have agreements with the rest of their neighboring states?
I can't swear it's with every state, but yeah, they do have agreements with their other neighbors. And this was an agreement that worked very well. In fact, a number of times in the past decade, Wisconsin has basically conceded Minnesota's concerns and has been willing to change the way in which the payments were made. But the fact is, for those of us that are representing everyday working people in these border cities, we just wish they could work together and get this done. It's happened before. It worked well before. Politics should not be in the way of a relatively simple issue for everyday folks.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Mayor Jim Payne of Superior. We're talking about tax reciprocity between Wisconsin and Minnesota. So how many people does it affect, and is it balanced or more one state or the other in our part of the state? Because actually I was speaking with one of my colleagues in La Crosse, and he seemed to think it may have been different there, that we had more Wisconsinites working in Minnesota and they have more Minnesota people working in Wisconsin, perhaps. But tell me what it really is.
I don't know the actual number statewide or even locally anymore, because even the data that we had is pretty old. But it's fair to say that there are more Wisconsinites, at least in our part of the state, that work in Minnesota. The Duluth area is a larger population and it's a larger economy. There are just more jobs over there and more folks cross the bridge going that direction for their work day. But on the other hand, Wisconsin has a lower income tax. And so the disparities get a little bit confusing, but on the whole, it affects both. And that's important to know. And it's several thousand people in the Twin Ports, because it doesn't matter which direction you're going for work. If you live in one state and you work in the other, you have to fill out two returns.
Mm-hmm. When I was at the Duluth News Tribune, we had quite a few employees from Wisconsin. This is probably not relevant, but one of them had a little ditty of sorts. Food and clothes, Minnesota, fridges and stoves, Wisconsin, or something like that. And yeah, she was talking about sales tax differences. But the point was that there were advantages to
both or each.
Can you speak to that at all? Or does that, I mean, is she right, by the way? Actually, food is not taxed in Wisconsin. I know that now. Yes.
That's right. That's right. So there, the clothing tax, there is no clothing tax in Minnesota. So if you're buying your school clothes for the year, there's also just more retail stores for clothing on that side of the bridge. But the sales tax is much lower on the Wisconsin side of the bridge. In fact, taxes across the board are lower on this side of the bridge. Income taxes are lower. Our property taxes tend to be a little bit higher, but when you consider state municipal fees, your whole bill is lower on the Wisconsin side. So on the whole, cost of living falls pretty significantly on this side of the bridge. But again, this issue is really just a matter of convenience. It's not a large economic issue, but it is one that impacts, especially workers on the lower income part of the income scale, because, that tax return ends up being a lifeline for low to moderate income workers. That's how they make those big purchases that you just described, with that kind of windfall that comes every spring. But if you're using a service like H&R Block or TurboTax, they're going to charge you quite a bit of money for each additional return. And it can eat into that return quite a bit for relatively low wage workers.
So what are the chances of it happening, getting passed?
Well, I've been optimistic every year for a decade, but I'm optimistic. I think we've got a really great Secretary of Revenue, and he has built a good relationship with his counterpart in Minnesota. The governors definitely get along very well. So if we can make this a priority, I think we could have a deal in the next year or two.
All right. We've been speaking with Mayor Jim Payne of Superior about tax reciprocity between Wisconsin and Minnesota and our neighboring states. Thanks for joining us, Mayor Payne.
Thank you very much.
As I noted, the push for tax reciprocity between Wisconsin and Minnesota was on the agenda of the Superior Day's delegation to Madison earlier this year, as was a similar call for refining an agreement about tuition reciprocity between the two states. That concerns students from Wisconsin who go to school in Minnesota or vice versa. There already is an agreement covering them, allowing students from each state to pay the rate that the other state would offer its own students, so long as it's the higher rate of the two states, and we can explain more about that in a minute. Currently, Minnesota's residential rate is higher than Wisconsin, so Minnesota residents would have to pay that amount when they attend a Wisconsin school. The suggested change doesn't affect the students, but who gets that extra amount? Right now, the difference paid by Minnesota students goes into the state of Wisconsin's general fund rather than to the actual college where the student is enrolled. Jordan Milan is Associate Vice Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Superior, and she's here to tell us why that should be changed. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Jordan.
Hi, Robin. Nice to be here.
So before we get into the crunching of the numbers here, how many students are there crossing the borders? And is this a matter of Sally or Johnny wanting to stay fairly close to home, but far enough away to break the apron strings from mom and dad?
Oh, of course, we do have students that fall into that category. About 30% of our students hail from Minnesota, And they could be as close as, you know, Duluth, or you can kind of right across the bridge, as we say. But we do also get a fair amount of students from central Minnesota, as well as the Twin Cities. And to your point, it is one of those types of things where we're far enough away from home to kind of get some of that freedom, but still close enough to get home quickly and easily. So.
Right. And not be shocked by the weather.
Right. Especially this year.
For that matter, let's just end this conversation and tell every student they should be going to school in Arizona or something like that. But anyway, so the reciprocity agreement that exists doesn't have any inherent inequity from the student point of view, or does it?
No, and actually it benefits Minnesota students coming to a Wisconsin school in that we have, you know, we have three different tuition rates. So we have our resident tuition rate for those who hail from Wisconsin. And then we have a non-resident rate for those who are outside of Wisconsin. But the Minnesota rate kind of falls in between those two. So if there wasn't a reciprocity agreement in place, these students would then be forced to pay the non-resident rate, which is the highest. So they do save some money, you know, with the reciprocity agreement. And as you had mentioned, what we're proposing would not impact students at all. It would not result in an increase in tuition for those students at all.
Mm-hmm. So your proposal is to do what?
So as mentioned, so, you know, the reciprocity agreement actually was first established in the 1970s. And right now that difference in tuition that Minnesota students pay, which is about $1,000 more than a student hailing from Wisconsin, that $1,000 is not retained by the university. Is it retained by UW-Superior or any of the universities? Instead, that money goes into the state general fund.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're proposing is, instead of that tuition going into the general fund, that you know, the university where that student is registered would be where that money stays. To give some context for UW-Superior, that difference in tuition, that tuition differential, as it's referred to, is actually quite significant. For UW-Superior, for example, that tuition differential totaled more than $800,000. So that $800,000 was not retained by the university. That went into the general fund.
Mm-hmm.
So what's being proposed is that we get to keep that tuition differential. Now, a part of the reciprocity agreement, of course, with Minnesota is there are some formulas that are put in place where some of that money does go back to the state of Minnesota. So the bills that were actually just recently introduced, both in the Senate and Assembly, would have that tuition differential go to a UW system account. UW system would then do those calculations and then send back what's owed to Minnesota, and then return the rest of that differential tuition balance to each of the universities that have those Minnesota students.
Mm-hmm. If I could play a bit of devil's advocate here, why shouldn't it go to the general fund? Doesn't that benefit all of us?
You know, in the context of the general fund, this tuition differential is, you know, just kind of a drop in the overall state budget bucket. And whereas for, you know, much smaller budgets like each of our UWs, that would make a larger proportion of our budget and would make a much bigger impact being used at the university where these students are going to school.
We're speaking with Jordan Milan. She's an associate vice chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Superior. We're talking about tuition reciprocity between colleges and universities in Wisconsin and Minnesota. I just said colleges and university, but does it only cover higher ed, by the way? What if my child wants to attend a private elementary or high school in another state? Although, you know, I don't know if those are state-run or not, but tell me.
That's a great question, Robin. And this tuition reciprocity agreement is only between University of Minnesota and University of Wisconsin institutions.
All right. Well, that answers that pretty straightforwardly. So you made the pitch at Superior Days, and you just mentioned there are bills in the Assembly and the Wisconsin State Senate. What are the chances of achieving the change you're looking for?
We are very hopeful this session. So there are both Assembly and Senate bills, AB 140 in the Assembly and SB 161 in the Senate. Both of these bills were sent to their respective college university committees. And the Assembly bill was co-authored by several representatives, including locally Representative Chance Green. And we're very appreciative for that support. Last session, these SB and AB bills were also introduced and they were in committee, but just weren't able to make it to the finish line before the session ended. So we're feeling very hopeful. We have bipartisan support. Everybody we've talked to, legislators, they're like, well, of course you should be able to keep the tuition revenue that you earn. So the folks we've been talking to really feel like it's kind of a no-brainer, and hopefully that sentiment continues on and we're able to get this to the finish line.
What about on the Minnesota side? I take it that Wisconsin couldn't just act unilaterally and say, well, actually, maybe they can, right? In this case, Minnesota's general fund isn't being affected.
Right. That is correct. And right now, the Higher Education AIDS Board in the state of Wisconsin is the one who negotiates that agreement. I believe in the new bills, they would also play a role in continuing to negotiate that agreement, but UW System would also be involved.
Could this change in the future if Minnesota changes tuition rates? I want to say lower, but I don't think lower is ever the part of the conversation. How about Wisconsin raise their rates? But whatever, in some way, Minnesota end up with the lower rate, and therefore, according to the agreement, the student pays the higher of the two in-state rates. So could that happen?
It certainly could. My guess is that it would be several years before that flip could take place. Since UW schools were under a tuition freeze for the last 10 years, we haven't moved on increasing tuition, whereas our friends in Minnesota have had those tuition increases. So for several years, Minnesota tuition has been kind of the prevailing tuition. And because of that 10-year freeze we had, I would imagine that it's going to stay that way for quite a few years.
All right. I'm going to offer you the chance to give a commercial. Tell a Minnesota listener, we have quite a few, who is thinking about college right now, why they should go to, I'm going to say the whole state of Wisconsin. I'm not going to limit it to just your school.
Well, I can certainly speak more for UW Superior. I will say, I guess speaking for UW Superior, for being a public institution, we have kind of a private college feel, very small class sizes. Faculty know their students by name and vice versa. It's just a very tight-knit community with great programs, awesome opportunities for experiential learning and getting out in the community. Almost half of our students are the first in their families to go to college, and that's something we're very, very proud of as well.
All right. We've been speaking with Jordan Mylan. She's Associate Vice Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Superior. We've been talking about tuition reciprocity between the colleges and universities in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Thank you for joining us, Jordan.
Thank you.
If you're watching this, it means I'm dead.
Coming up, a local screenwriter makes it to Hollywood.
Daniel can share his fortune, but that means you will have to spend the weekend together. You're watching this, it means I'm dead.
Daniel now has the freedom to walk away with everything. You all would get nothing if you don't adhere to the rules of your father.
Daniel can share his fortune, but that means you will have to spend the weekend together at our family beach house.
Killing him is the only option.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Matt Dressel of Duluth is a Hollywood screenwriter, and last year on the show we heard his story of how he became one. He first wrote his screenplay about, I think, a decade ago and pitched it to more than 600 agents and film companies. A few dozen actually got back to him with rejections. But one of those took a second look and a financer materialized, and a cast and big names and filming in the Cayman Islands of all places, and the result, a clip from which you just heard, is now celebrating its theatrical premiere and already racking up accolades. And here to tell us the rest of the story is Matt Dressel. Welcome back to Simply Superior, Matt.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So are you still pinching yourself over all of this?
Oh, yeah. It's just, when you do this for about 12 years and that's the whole process. And then, so much of it was just just in the idea phase. So much of it was just doing rewrites of the script and talking about the idea that one day this might become a movie. And then all of a sudden, you know, the green light goes, and it's just kind of phenomenal how quickly everything progresses from that point. So it's just, you know, about a decade's worth of work and just dreams. And then all of a sudden you're in the Cayman Islands and shooting, and then the movie's done and it's at festivals. And yeah, it's just, it's hard to believe.
All right. Well, keep pinching yourself, because it is real, and no one's going to wake you up and say, Matt, you've been dreaming this whole time.
Yeah.
Well, how about giving us a brief synopsis of the plot, since you did have a few years to work on it, and maybe tell us about a couple of changes you made along the script's long journey. One of them I know is you kept going through a bunch of different titles, and the last time you were on, it was Blue Iguana. Remember that?
I do remember that title. Yeah. So the plot of it is that there's a family of rich sociopaths, and the father, played by Iggy Pop, dies, and he leaves all of his money to the good son, the only good one in the family, named Daniel. And he tells him he can either keep it all himself or he can share it with his siblings. And he decides that he's going to share it with his siblings, and that means they have to spend the weekend together at their beach house in the Cayman Islands. But his siblings decide that instead of doing that, they'd rather just try and kill Daniel. So it's kind of all of the plans that intersect and everything that goes awry. And yeah, over the last, you know, 10 years that I've been writing it, it started as a script it took place at a cabin in the woods in my mind in Michigan. And, you know, then we changed that to an extravagant mansion / beach house in the Cayman Islands, and had to swap out. There was, you know, there was a possum prominently featured in the first draft of the script, but obviously there are no possums in the Cayman Islands. So we changed it to the iguana. And that's kind of how the title Blue Iguana came about. But that was very much a working title at the time. We then changed it a couple more times until we landed on Daniel's Gotta Die. And that's kind of where we're at with the title now.
Ah, okay. So I thought it was Killing Daniel, no?
That was the very, very original title, oh, so many years ago.
Ah, okay. All right, I'm not off. I'm just not quite up to date. This was Bob Saget's last film, so tell me about him and his role.
Yeah, so he's the one who's kind of wrangling the sociopathic siblings and keeping everybody in check. And when we sent him the script, he just absolutely loved it. He was so enthusiastic. We hopped on a Zoom call almost immediately to just start discussing his character. And he really wanted to inject more heart, more drama into his character. He really wanted to see the range that he could bring to this role. And when he showed up on set, he went around and shook hands with every single crew member, introduced himself, and was just the absolute nicest guy. And he was such a cheerleader for the project. And right when the movie wrapped, he brought one of the stars of the film, Mary Lynn Rice Cub, on his podcast, and they talked about their experiences on the film.
Well, we can't let that go by without hearing some of it. Although we lost Bob Saget in the beginning of 2022, his Bob Saget's Here For You podcasts are still up at podcast.apple.com. Here he is with Mary Lynn Rice Cub in April 2021.
I have a guest today that I just love. It's Mary Lynn Rice Cub, and she is a fantastic actress that you know for many years, from all the way from Mr. Show to Larry Sanders Show to Chloe on 24. Hello. And she has a movie coming out, and it's a big movie starring Chris Pratt, and it's called The Tomorrow War. And I just did a movie with her that's right now called Blue Iguana, might be called Killing Daniel. I think the most fun that we've had was what we just experienced.
This was an amazing experience. Unreal.
So walk the all of our listeners and possible viewers through what we did and what the hell, how did this happen for you?
So I get a call from my agent saying, before I've even read the script, can you go to the Cayman Islands in 2 days? For 5 weeks during the pandemic. I don't even have to read the script. The answer is yes, I can.
Am I dressed?
I run out without any shoes in my underwear to get to the Cayman Islands as fast as possible. I was lucky to be able to pull it off. And then also, it was really lucky that the script was good, you know, because I already was going to go. And then I read it and I was like, "What? When is the other shoe going to drop?" And it just never did. The whole thing was such a lovely, from quarantining in a resort overlooking the beach, it could not have been better. To the way that we were treated, to having, on your day off, you just take a few steps and you're in the most beautiful place you've ever been.
And people need to know that there were no COVID cases because they put us in quarantine for real.
And that was the late Bob Saget speaking with Mary Lynn Ricegub on the Bob Saget's Here For You Apple podcast. They were talking about the movie they were just in, written by Duluth's Matt Dressel, who is terribly modest because you just heard Mary Lynn Ricegub gushing about his script and the entire production. Matt, you were telling us just how much Bob Saget was into it for what would ultimately end up being his last film.
Yeah, I just know it meant a lot to him. You know, he really wanted to make sure that he gave it his all. He wanted to show something to people that was outside of what he considered just being a sitcom actor. Mm-hmm. And so it hurts that he never got to see any of his work. He never got to see anything because he wanted to see the polished, finished film. And unfortunately, you know, we just had a rough cut at the time. And so he never got to see how absolutely great he was in this final role.
Well, I'm sure he will get posthumous accolades for it and well-deserved. We're speaking with Matt Dressel. He's the screenwriter of the Hollywood film, I'm going to say it right, Daniel's Gotta Die, shot in the Cayman Islands. It's just had its theatrical premiere in Duluth and elsewhere. Let's hear the trailer.
Dad, Daniel, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to get my brother and my two sisters and I'm going to bring them in here so that we can be together as a family.
No, don't you do that.
If you're watching this, it means I'm dead.
Daniel now has the freedom to walk away with everything. You all would get nothing if you don't adhere to the rules of your father.
Daniel can share his fortune, but that means you will have to spend the weekend together at our family beach house.
Killing him is the only option.
Isn't there like a less violent way?
We got board games!
I'll think about it.
It's great, huh?
If this place could talk,
we'd tell you to shut the f*** up.
Do you know what I did for your father?
What do you want?
I just want what's mine. And you're going to help me get it.
I need to give this to you.
Oh, ooh.
It's poison. You put it in his wine.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Daniel?
You think he's dead?
Not unless the dead breathe. Get it done.
What would you like me to use?
Use the machete.
Daniel! We've got to kill Daniel.
I'm beginning to like you more and more.
No one's ever said that to me before.
I understand why.
What?
You know what they say. You want something done? It's go time.
I don't know how to explain it, but there's something weird going on here.
This should do the trick.
All I wanted was to bring my family together.
And that was a clip from Daniel's Gotta Die. It's Bob Saget's last film, written by Matt Dressel of Duluth. Tell us about the other actors in the film and, of course, the director. I mean, you know, I'm not going to diminish your role, but you're just the writer.
That's true. Yeah, there is. So that was, you know, one of the biggest components, obviously, the next step once we were going through development was finding the appropriate director, finding somebody who really understood the voice of the script and just had a really good, you know, comedic brain for all of this. And Jeremy Lalonde at the time, you know, he's a Canadian director. I wasn't really familiar with his work, but when they talked about bringing him on, I kind of just went through and devoured his work. I went and looked at everything that he's done, and it became very, very apparent quickly that he has a great comedic eye. He has great comedic timing. He edits all of his own, you know, work, and he really understands the rules of comedy. And most importantly, he really liked the script and he thought that he could bring something really valuable to it. And he brought this kind of unique view to it. He looked at it almost like a Hitchcock film. When we were in quarantine in the Cayman Islands, you know, we had to kill about 2 weeks of quarantine. And so we were all just kind of consuming a lot of media. And during that time, he was just studying the films of Hitchcock and looking at the cinematography and the beats. And so that's kind of what he brought to it. And I think he did a really great job with it. And as far as the cast, it just actually won Best Ensemble Cast at the Garden State Film Festival in New Jersey. And they did a tremendous job pulling together a cast. They've got, you know, Joel David Moore from Grandma's Boy and Avatar, and Mary Lynn Rice Cub, who's most notable from 24 and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Jason Jones, who was originally cut his teeth on The Daily Show. And of course, we know we had talked about Bob Saget and Iggy Pop. It was just, it's just such a tremendous cast. And it was great seeing each one of them take the characters and bring them to life in their own unique way.
Mm-hmm. And you said quarantine, this was shot during COVID. By the way, during COVID is probably like the rest of human existence. So, I mean, supposedly it's officially over U.S. quarantine wise. But anyway, this was during, again, the height of COVID, or definitely pronounced COVID.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was, you know, right before COVID hit, we had different people financing the project. We were heading towards production. And when COVID hit, it basically shut everything down. And I really thought at that point, well, this is it. You know, there's no more movie. And it really did look like that, just because the whole industry didn't really know what was going to happen. And so the executive producer who came on and ended up funding this basically took us to the Cayman Islands, and he took an entire Canadian crew, the whole crew, and he flew them in. And everybody was there for 6 months, and they shot three films back to back. But to do that, everybody, every single person who went there had to quarantine for 2 weeks. So we were all just shut up in our rooms. It was very, very strict. Everything about it was very closely monitored. But then when we got out, you know, it was kind of amazing. I mean, it was the height of COVID, and we were able to just walk around as if COVID wasn't a thing. Mm-hmm. And we all felt truly blessed by that. That was, you know, at a time that the entire world was hurting, it was really amazing to be able to have just that period to just kind of breathe a little bit.
What was that time period exactly? When were you there?
We were there in, I arrived on February 2021.
And yeah, I mean, part of it, I think you've told us, was, you know, promotions, the Cayman Islands wanting people to shoot films there, or people wanting to shoot there. But also, I mean, I guess because of COVID, it was obviously as isolated. It's an island, right?
So yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that was another benefit to it. And will it be in general release? Of course, it has had its premiere in Duluth, and as you pointed out, the Garden State Film Festival and other places. And I put an asterisk on general release because I'm not even sure how that works these days.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, it's still a little up in the air. It's still enjoying its festival run, you know. Mm-hmm. It's had a few really great plays, and then next month it's heading to the LA Comedy Film Festival, then it's heading to the Monte Carlo Comedy Film Festival. And so hopefully we'll keep getting some good word of mouth there. And then, yeah, it's kind of, it's up in the air. We'll see where it lands, whether or not it gets a small theatrical run or ends up on a streaming service somewhere near you. It will be somewhere. It will be, you know, I'm sure widely available soon enough. And we're very excited to get it out there.
Yeah. Well, I recently got a Roku TV. I guess I cut the cord of the cable, and there are about a million things out there. I'm sure you'll be in it. So, no way that's not going to happen. Speaking of filmmaking, we've had, and you and I have talked about this before, all sorts of local boosterism of filmmaking in town or in the area. And we have been critical of some of that on this show by looking at the finances of one of those nonprofits. We don't need to get into that now. There's a backlog at the IRS, so we haven't been able to check 990 nonprofit filings recently. But what would you say is the most realistic path for a local person wanting to get into film or TV or streaming services or whatever they are out there today?
You know, I would say it's just to find the resources in your area that are working to support that foundation. I do work with the Minnesota Film Festival, which is where it just premiered. But then a part of that, a component of that, is the Minnesota Art School, where we teach editing and screenwriting and more of the specialized skills that you need to make it in the industry. Because, you know, I can't say that there's a huge industry here. I can say that there are productions coming, small and medium productions that are coming here, and they are looking for crew. They're looking for people who are specialized in certain areas. So I can say the best thing you can do, like any profession, is just learn, is do the best you can to find these resources like the Minnesota Art School, or even just taking a, non-paying or low-paying job on a film set just for the experience. Some people just have to apprentice as they're doing these things. And just work your way up. But aside from that, I think just making stuff. I think that, throughout my entire career, even though, the climate keeps changing, the methods which you release things keep changing, the message has always been the same from anybody I talk to. Just keep finding ways to make things. You just mentioned yourself, there's no shortage of things out there, but there's no shortage of services, especially for an independent filmmaker. I know several independent filmmakers in the area who made, no to low budget films, but then they get them out there on something like Tubi or any number of free services, but they're wide services where they reach a lot of people and they get views that, 10 years ago they wouldn't have gotten before.
Mm-hmm. And of course, perseverance, which you know something about.
Exactly.
What do you say? I asked you this before, but, what do you say to the Matt Dressel of, 7 years ago, who has probably 400 rejections into that total 600?
I would say, that every single rejection was just one step closer to getting that yes. And it really is just pushing through and finding that one moment that works. There's just, you can't just sit back and wait for something to happen. For this entire process, I had to go out and actively, virtually knock on doors. And I sent out probably, 500 to 600 emails trying to beg people to read this script. And, when the emails didn't work, I made a promo video. I made a 45-second promo video that explained the script just to make it that much easier. And it's just, you have to continually reinvent yourself and just push. And so, it's really about just not giving up.
Do you have any idea why, actually, that particular person who took the second look took a second look? Or will you ever know?
I guess I'll never know. I'm not sure.
All right, let's leave it at that. That's actually kind of intriguing. What's next? At this point, this is kind of a wrap on this. You got to have something else brewing out there.
Yeah, I mean, right now I'm working on my web series, which is called The Pilot is Dead, where I look at old unproduced television pilots that got one shot and then never went anywhere. And that's fun. That's one of my hobbies. I love undiscovered media. I'm working on my own kind of anti-film festival called the Junk Food Film Festival, which kind of celebrates that whole culture anyway, VHS culture and Grindhouse and all these like delightful things that I love to watch, that I love to find. And then as far as film goes, I'm just looking for that next project. I really do believe in like the local scene, and I do believe in trying to make something here. And I obviously love being a part of the community. So I would like to make something that's 100% mine, that I can just premiere here for my local community and see where it goes, but just to have fun again and really just like push myself creatively.
Mm-hmm. What's the name again of your pilot project?
It's called The Pilot is Dead.
Okay. It sounds like the film equivalent of a one-hit wonder, except the one-hit wonders were actually hits.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. It's a really interesting look at all the projects that never were. And you're just kind of, you look at them and you're like, how did this ever receive funding? And there's a lot of ridiculous stuff out there that never actually saw the light of day.
Well, having gone this far on this, what stands out? There's got to be something interesting.
I mean, there's, one of my favorites is the episode I did on Puchinsky, which was Peter Boyle of Everybody Loves Raymond fame, who is a hard-nosed detective who gets killed in the line of duty, and then he transfers his soul into the body of a talking bulldog. And then he goes to solve his murder. And so that one's just absolutely ridiculous. And there's so many dog plots. There's so many dog pilots about dogs. It's absolutely unreal.
Did you say Puchinsky?
Puchinsky, yes.
That's the name of a now deceased, I'm sure, alderman and a former congressman from Chicago. The alderman was a more important job in Chicago because you get patronage and everything. I wonder if they thought, you know, his name recognition down there would help.
Oh, man, I don't think they were creative enough for that. I think they just saw the word pooch and put it in there.
Oh, that kind of, okay, all right, the spelling's yeah. different. All right, we're going to leave this alone. We've gone way too far on this, and we need to. All right, well, we've been speaking with Matt Dresso. He's the screenwriter of the Hollywood film shot in the Cayman Islands, Daniel's Gotta Die. I got the right name there. It's just had its theatrical premiere in Duluth, and it's on the festival circuit, already racking up accolades. Thank you for joining us, Matt.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Crazy ass white people.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And Shalon Monroe, multimedia journalist for WDIO-TV. Hello, Shalon.
Hello, Robin.
So, Shalon, probably the biggest news in Wisconsin this week was also one of the biggest stories nationwide. That was the election of Janet Protasiewicz to the state Supreme Court, which would flip the court from conservative to liberal.
Yes, Robin, that is correct. Justice-elect Janet Protasiewicz won the race with 55%, 1,021,370 votes, over Judge Dan Kelly with 44%, 818,280 votes. Now, this is significant because there are two items that would likely come up in front of the court, one being the state's century-old abortion ban, and the next being the redistricting of the state legislative maps that lean Republican. Dan Kelly was previously a justice on the state Supreme Court, first appointed by former Governor Scott Walker in 2016. He was defeated by Jill Karoski in the 2020 election and sought to regain a seat this year. The next opportunity conservatives will have to take the course will be in April 2025 when Liberal Justice Ann Wash Bradley is up for re-election.
Well, I understand the counties in our area contributed significantly to her win. That's despite voters having flipped the area's legislative seats from Democratic to Republican last fall. What was her margin of victory locally?
So first start off in Ashland County, where she won 63% to 36%. And from there, we head to Bayfield, where she won 64% to 35%. And then down to Douglas County, where she won 61% to 39%.
Well, politics aside, one thing we'll have to get used to is pronouncing the new justice's name, Protasiewicz. I've been practicing that. And she had something herself to say about this.
That is correct. Now, she actually posted a video on Twitter.
I'm Judge Janet Protasiewicz.
She made it easier for everyone with that video.
All right. Well, a far less contentious statewide issue was heard this week with a budget proposal by Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers to increase funding for the State Office of Outdoor Recreation. WPR's Danielle Kading has this report.
Evers wants to make three positions permanent and provide around $1 million to the office over the next 2 years. Outdoor recreation added $8.7 billion to the state's economy in 2021. That's a 14% increase from 2020 when people flocked to the outdoors during the pandemic. Tourism Secretary Ann Sayers told Assembly lawmakers on Tuesday outdoor recreation is one of the state's top tourism drivers.
Imagine what this office can do if we give them a stable future with permanent staff and funding.
Sayers says the agency supports a nearly $21 billion industry with funding far less than 1% of the overall budget. Some GOP lawmakers say that's still a lot of money, while others say the agency provides the best bang for its buck. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And from outdoor tourism, we'll go indoors, where I understand a new professional sports team will be playing in Duluth.
That is right. And this time it's not hockey because we're taking it indoors to Arena Football. On Wednesday, former Oakland Raider, NFL Hall of Famer, and Heisman Trophy winner Tim Brown, the commissioner of the Arena League, said that Duluth is part of four teams, one that has been named in Springfield, Missouri, the other two that have not been formally determined yet. And the play will start in 2024.
So is this a major league sport?
So right now, the league is really just starting up. Arena Football League officials say that they chose Duluth because of its enthusiastic fan base. But yes, this really will be a professional football team.
Well, four teams may sound like a modest beginning, but 100 years ago, Duluth had one of the first teams in what became the NFL, the Duluth Eskimos. And playing indoors may not be a bad idea considering the weather we've been having. Rick, I thought it was spring.
It's supposed to be, but it's on hold at the moment. Other than messing up your morning commute and adding some more snow to shovel, this week's winter storm did accomplish something else. It moved Duluth closer to having the snowiest winter on record. The National Weather Service in Duluth officially reported a storm total of 2.3 inches of snow and sleet as of Wednesday, bringing the seasonal total to 131.3 inches. Now, that's good enough for third place on the snowiest winter list, but still behind the 131.8 from 1949 and 50, and just over 4 inches behind the overall record, which is 135.4 inches that was set in 1994 and 95. So we have a little bit of work to do, but it does appear that true spring is just around the corner. High temperatures are expected to start rising this weekend and into next week, and not stop until highs reach the 60s into next week. And they're expected to stay there at least for a few days as spring arrives with some true force. So time may be running out on the chances to top that record.
I've seen some very unofficial online polls on various social media asking people if we should go for the record, as if we have any influence in that. Rick, what do you think, though? You want to place a bet on it?
I would not place a bet on it because there's still several days left in April, and as you know, we can get snow all the way into May. But put me in the column of people that want to not break the record.
Okay. Well, just like the cold weather sticking around, the proposed Northern Lights Express train to the Twin Cities from Duluth Superior has been on the drawing board seemingly forever, but it's a few feet closer to getting on track.
Yes, it appears that way. A long-sought passenger rail line between Duluth and the Twin Cities appears closer than ever to reality this year, with both the Minnesota House and Senate versions of a transportation budget, including funding for the service. Advocates for the Northern Lights Express Rail project, who have been pushing for years to restore Twin Cities to Duluth passenger rail travel, say this year is the closest the state has come to funding the line. Estimates have placed the price tag of the project at about $450 million, but Minnesota would only have to chip in about 20% of the total, as the federal government would pay $4 for every $1 from the state. Now, as DFL majority lawmakers prepare their major budget bills, both the Senate and House transportation packages contain funding for Northern Lights Express, but there's a key difference between the proposals. The House version calls for $194 million to get the line started, whereas the Senate version calls for $50 million. The amount in the current Senate proposal would fall short of what's needed to get the matching federal funds. Meanwhile, the $194 million would unlock nearly $1 billion, far more than the estimated cost of the project. A Senate DFL spokesman said there's a commitment in both chambers to get the project funded, and while there's a discrepancy in funding now, they believe it'll get hammered out later on in the session in a conference committee between the House and the Senate. Supporters of the Northern Lights Express are enthusiastic this year about the odds for the proposed rail line now that the DFL controls all three branches of state government. GOP lawmakers question if the level of ridership and the length of the trip would justify the expense, but the Minnesota Department of Transportation estimates a trip on Northern Lights Express would take about 2.5 hours and could possibly outperform drive times depending on weather and traffic. If funding comes, advocates say service would begin in about 3 years. Northern Lights Express would use 152 miles of existing railway track and connect Target Field in downtown Minneapolis to the St. Louis County Depot in Duluth, and stops are planned in Coon Rapids, Cambridge, Hinckley, and Superior.
All right, we've been joined by Rick Lovers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
And Shalon Monroe, multimedia journalist for WDIO-TV. Thank you, Shalon.
Thank you, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org, DuluthNewsTribune.com, and WDIO.com.
And finally, Today is Good Friday, and Easter Sunday is just around the corner. It's also the middle of Ramadan, which began on March 22nd and goes through April 20th, and tonight is the third night of Passover. We wish a healthy and joyous spring holiday season to all who celebrate. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. Ezra Wall is our executive producer. We received production assistance from Kate Spranger, and our theme song was written and performed by Bruce Nelson. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view. Gathered to mirror your life and interest with the goal of helping you to understand the world we live in and the region we hold dear by sharing the stories and information you'll enjoy and